Welcome to the Rust Belt Science Podcast. I'm your host, Maggie Fink.
And I am Shahir Rizk.
And today we have a very special guest. We have Dr. Deb Marr, who is a professor of biology at Indiana University South Bend. So we're very excited to have you here today, Deb.
Thanks so much for having me.
Awesome. So we want to start out every episode with a guest asking a basic question. Is there anything exciting you're listening to, reading right now, maybe watching? It doesn't even have to be like science-y, but what are you listening to, watching for fun?
So I have to confess that during the semester, I'm pretty focused on my classes, but that doesn't mean I'm not having fun. So, for example, right now in Biology L101, which is an intro bio course, we're covering the cell cycle, mitosis, and meiosis. So these are really basic ways that cells divide. And it turns out Nikon had the 2024 winner of Small World Videos. And one of those videos shows a Drosophila larva doing waves of mitosis. So I'm always looking for visual things that I can include in the class to help people sort of develop that visual thing of what's going on at really small levels. Mm-hmm. And the reason why I got into that is because another one of the winners was a tardigrade riding a nematode. And then I started checking out all the other Small World videos. So anyway, so tardigrades are organisms that live in the soil, which is one of my passions. Sure. And so anyway, I got into it for that. And then I've also been reading about centrosomes. So centrosomes are involved in mitosis, primarily animal cells, but plants don't have them and fungi don't have them.
Okay.
So one of the things that I was – so, you know, this has been known for a long time, but there's some really interesting things like – so how does that affect the organism? And I would say a lot of those answers are unknown, but for example, ferns – like Ophioglossum mm-hmm. reticulatum has over 1,000 chromosomes in its nucleus. I think 1,260.
Wow, I did not know that.
Penicillium, which is a fungus, has 4 chromosomes in its nucleus. And then humans, we have 46 chromosomes in our nuclei. And so just thinking about how these cells divide and the mechanics of how that works, and how that kind of affects what that organism is and how they function. So anyway, so I'm reading really fun papers about centrosomes and tardigrades riding nematodes and that kind
of
thing.
That's super cool. I did not know that about ferns. I know ferns are unique in a lot of ways, but I did not know that. It's interesting that we can have so many, that something as simple as cell dividing can look so different and all these different organisms. That's cool. It's science-y, but I'll accept it because that's a tardigrade riding a nematode.
Yeah, you know, when we were asking this question, you know, what are you watching? I thought it was going to be like TV, like some sort of like, I don't know, dating show on TV.
Yeah, my answer was reality TV.
I know, that's what I thought. But you know, this is so much cooler.
I've never had a TV in my, well, so I did grow up with a TV.
Right, right.
But then, mm-hmm. you know, undergrad, graduate school, I've in postdoc, and now as a professor, I've never had a TV. But you can stream things, of course.
Yes, yeah, now everybody's streaming. Now nobody really uses their TV except to stream things, which you can stream on your phone or on your iPad.
I should say during the summer when we travel, I do like to read. I love to read history books about the history of the place that we are. There's a really wonderful series of short histories of the provinces of Canada that's a fabulous intro to the history of the provinces. And I love mystery novels, but that's a summertime thing because I get sucked in and I want to read and I need to stay focused. So, yeah, during the semester, I'm learning all the cool things about a really diverse number of subjects because when you're teaching intro bio, you're covering a lot of things.
Do you find that even though you've been teaching these intro courses for a while, that you learn something new every semester?
Absolutely. Like the centrosomes. So I've been teaching mitosis and meiosis for over 20 years, every semester, in some form or another. Wow. Like, this is really basic biology. Mm-hmm. Every intro student will have this. So I've gone through it a lot of time. But every time I do it, we learn new, and we're still learning new things about how cells divide, and different cells divide in different ways. I think the trick is when you've done something so much that you don't bombard the students with too much detail. So there's a balance between what is helpful to get people interested that are new to the field. And then there's also the point of too much detail that you just snowed everybody under terminology. So, sure. But for me, yeah, I learn new things every semester, even though I've been doing it for kind of a long time.
Yeah. Cool.
Oh, that's really cool. So, you know, you found these videos from, you said it was the Nikon 2024, you know,
small world in motion videos.
Yeah. And this is Drosophila, cell division. So Drosophila is fruit flies, essentially.
Fruit flies, yes.
And they're just dividing, and you're watching them under the microscope dividing.
Yeah.
That's pretty cool.
It's fabulous, beautiful microscopy. Yeah.
And you share that with the students.
Yes.
Yeah.
Next week, so this is foreshadowing next week's lab, because in next week's lab, we're studying the fruit fly life cycle.
Oh, cool. Yeah.
So this kind of adds into that.
So they haven't seen the videos yet?
Or they have not.
Yeah.
I'm working a week ahead.
Yeah, I'm curious to see how they react to these kinds of, you know, what would you say, supplemental information you give them outside of the course.
We'll have to ask them.
I
think videos that kind of show what's happening, because this is a dynamic process, and we look at these still images all the time, but that's not really what's going on. So these short little videos can help you sort of picture what's going on. So I think it probably is helpful, but we'll have to ask them next week.
Sure. We can maybe have your class on and say, how did Dr. Marr do? How was that video?
So you're at IU South Bend right now.
I am.
As a professor of biology. But how did you make it to IU South Bend? You're not a South Bend native, are you?
No. I'm from upstate New York. And then I did my undergraduate work in New York, Binghamton University, which is one of the state universities in the us old-timers call it the SUNY system, but anyway, now it's just the state university system. But then I did my PhD down at IU Bloomington, so that brought me to Indiana for the first time in my life. And then after that, I did a postdoc at Vanderbilt University, which is in Nashville, Tennessee. And I was there for 3 years. And I should also say that while I was a graduate student, I actually was doing my research out in Colorado. So in the summers, I was out in Colorado. And then in the winters, I was in southern Indiana. And then at Vanderbilt, I was doing work in the Cedar Glades in Tennessee, but also in Florida. So actually, one of the places that I worked is going to be hit possibly by a hurricane tomorrow.
Yeah.
And then I also did some work in Georgia and Alabama, so working on yuccas and yuccamas. And then I applied for jobs all over the U.S. and ended up at IU South Bend. And I have to say that it was probably the best fit ever, because it's allowed me to do – I was interested in teaching, but I was interested in keeping an active research program that involved undergraduates. And IU South Bend has allowed me to do that. I have great colleagues. We have great collaborations across chemistry, physics, and biology that can allow you to kind of develop undergraduate research projects in really interesting ways. So it's been a great place to be. It was a good choice.
Well, we're very happy that you ended up at IU South Bend for sure.
What would an undergraduate research project look like, right? It's very different than when you're in grad school doing research, which is more of your full-time job as research. Whereas an undergrad, you're taking courses, and research is kind of an extra thing you can do in a lot of cases. And I did research as an undergrad, but it must look very different for the type of research that you do. Can you tell us a little bit about what those projects might look like and some of the things you've had your students work on?
So I should say, so I'm an ecologist, and I do field biology. So I do a lot of outside field work. And then I also do lab work as well. So, and that lab work can be molecular, figuring out the genetics of individuals. It can be microscopy, so studying things at in closer detail. And then also greenhouse experiments. So in terms of students, one of the things that I try to do whenever possible, it helps if the student is interested in the question. And so I try to match the question to the student's interest. Sometimes you just have to once the student gets into it, then they get interested. Mm-hmm. And certainly the last couple of years, I think that's been more the case because I've been doing more tree and soil research. And so so I think students who, in particular, like in the Bendix Woods project, we were doing a survey of all of the trees in the old growth forest to look at how tree composition has changed over 50 years. And when I started, I think the students maybe weren't necessarily as excited about the question as I was. But as we got into it, they were fabulous. And every day we were out there for hours on end. And so sometimes just getting immersed in something gets you interested mm-hmm. in that thing. Mm-hmm. So in terms of working with the students, it really depends on what the time frame is like. For the summers, it's more intense. And do it, you know, in terms of working multiple hours a day. If it's during the semester, it might only be, you know, a couple of hours a week that the students. So I try to match the scale of the project and time intensity because you have to kind of balance things. But this summer, for example, one of the students who worked with me, we were doing soil ecology. And so when we started, we're collecting all these soils. And it wasn't until the students started every day looking at these soils and what lives in the soils. And by the end of the first week, she was like, I had no idea there was so much living stuff in soils. And so then she got hooked. So sometimes you just have to, ramp them into the interest.
Sure. Yeah.
You just have to throw them into the project. And then that's kind of where the love for it develops because they might not know it in the first place.
A lot of times we don't know. Yeah. I mean, if you've never looked at soils, how would you know what's living there?
That's true. Yeah. So speaking of soil, you said you're working on old growth forests and the soil around them. How old are these old growth forests, just to give us an idea?
Yeah. So so I should probably back up. So let's define old growth.
Yes.
So old growth means that the trees that are there have been in place for hundreds of years, and it has not been logged substantially by humans. So in our case, and so when you get an old growth forest, you're going to have greater diversity of age structure. So in St. Joseph County, the only substantial old growth forest is Bendix Woods. Mm-hmm. It's about 11 hectares. And it was developed. So the oldest trees in that preserve are like 350 years old.
Wow.
And so that preserve in the 1970s, Lindsay Holton, he helped develop the Indiana Nature Preserve system. And that's what kind of got that old growth forest preserved. And because he did that initial census in the late 1960s, early 1970s, and then Vic Riemenschneider, who was the ecologist before me, he did a census in the 1980s. And then in 2019, he and I went out there.
Wow.
And he turned over all of his data. And he had talked with Lindsay Alton. Wow. So he knew the original person who had done the census. And then he had done the census in the 1980s. So I was able to talk with him. He actually came out with our 2019 ecology class.
Yeah.
And then it wasn't until 21, 22 that we finished the census. But it was an unusual project in that we were able to use the same methods, building on 50 years worth of data, which is fairly rare, maybe, to be able to directly talk with people. Obviously, you can consult the literature to see what people have done, but it's different talking with somebody.
I'm sure.
So anyway, we censused all the trees, and then we've been able to look at how age structures changed over time, how the species composition of the trees has changed over time. We were also able to go back to the 1800s. So land surveyors, where they came and did an initial survey, their data wasn't as detailed, but it gave us an idea of the dominant trees, subdominant, and so forth. So to be honest, that was my first dive into trees.
Yeah.
I've hugged a lot of trees, over 21,000 trees at this point. But for the most part, up until that point, I've worked on not necessarily shorter-lived organisms, but much smaller organisms. Mm-hmm. So, for example, my PhD work was on Silenia callis, which is a little cushion plant that occurs in the alpine tundra, so that's more west of here. And it can live 100 to 300 years, so very long-lived, but really it's not higher than your ankle. Wow. So it's really small. It's a cushion plant. So it's growing up so high, there are no trees, the wind is so high, it's only short things that can grow. Mm. And I was looking at a really specific relationship between an anthers mutt fungus and the plant. And so this anthers mutt fungus kind of converts the flowers to producing fungal spores instead of pollen. So it takes over the whole reproductive cycle. And so I was looking at how pollinators are transmitting these fungal spores and also what's the rate of disease spread in such a long-lived organism.
Mm.
Because there's many short-lived Silene where the disease spread goes much faster. And then in Tennessee, I was working on yuccas and yuccamas. Again, a really highly specialized system between a pollinator and the plant. The yuccamas are the only insect that can pollinate the plant, and the plant is the only food in the world that the yuccamas can eat. So really highly specialized. And they occur in the Southeast. I was traveling all over the Southeast studying them. And then when I came up to South Bend, I couldn't pursue either one of those projects because Colorado is not near Indiana. And the yuccas and yuccamas, they're doing their stuff in April and May, which is during a semester. So I switched systems to hydrophyllum, which is an understory plant. And there are three different species that occur in St. Joseph County. And it gets a soil fungus that causes wilt. And when I first started that system, so I was working in the understory forest. So this was, got me into the forest systems. But what got me into soils was that I was trying to figure out what was causing this wilt disease. Mm. And so I started collecting roots and then plating them out on petri dishes. And there were all these fungi that were growing out, like dozens of fungi that were growing out. So then we had to figure out, okay, which one of these fungi is actually causing the disease. Yeah. And so we figured out it was a Fusarium species. Fusarium is a really common soil fungus. It infects over 80% of our crops. And some of these, so the interesting thing was that some of these fungi cause disease, but some don't. Mm. And so then that got me into what causes a fungal strain to be, to not cause disease versus those that flip over into the pathogenic range. So anyway, worked on that for a while, got into some tall grass prairie restoration, and then got back to the Bendix project, mainly because it was time. We were coming up on the 50 years, and so doing another census. So trees is not, it's a recent thing.
It's a recent thing. It's a new fling.
It's a new fling, but it is becoming a fling.
Well, it's just so amazing to have a project go for so long and have it be passed down from one professor to another and actually have that experience of I was here and now this has changed in the last 20 or 30 or 40 or 50 years. I mean, that's really cool. And I feel like the students who are working on this must have some appreciation for this because they're in their lifetimes, their entire lifetime is kind of a blip when it comes to the whole project.
Yeah. So we would joke in the field, who was going to do the next census?
Yes.
So they were voting on who would be most likely to do the next census. But, we have to wait several decades before.
Yeah. That's fantastic. When you're talking about the yucca and the yucca moths, these two organisms basically live, you could say, for each other, or they cannot live without each other.
I think it's better to say they can't live without each other.
Yeah.
But yes, both their life cycles are intimately connected.
Yeah.
And if one goes extinct, then the other will not be able to complete its life cycle either.
Right. Yeah. So I know that they are two different organisms, but, in ecology, there's the idea of organism environment, that they are kind of inseparable. And this is just my biochemist brain thinking, are they really two separate things or are they just one thing that to us are classified as two things? One is a plant and one is an animal.
So I think they're definitely two species that have evolved independently.
Right.
Over a million years ago, their life cycles got intertwined.
Yeah.
And it probably started off as a generalist partnership, but then became more specialized over time. And once you get into that specialized evolution route, then it can kind of lock you in and make you vulnerable in some ways. But it also allows you to have a resource that nobody else has access to. Yeah. So there's, you know, pluses and minuses. It's definitely, there's costs and benefits. So one of the things we looked at, so why don't the moths just lay as many eggs as they can per fruit and eat all the seeds?
Yeah.
And the plant, if too many eggs are laid, it causes a wounding response and the flowers just drop off. So they select against any moth that tries to be greedy. I just love it.
Wow. That's amazing.
My mind is just racing because this is so cool. This is the kind of science stuff I like to learn for fun. Mm-hmm. You know,
it is fun.
It is so interesting, and it seems so impractical for two different organisms to develop this type of relationship. What would drive that to happen evolutionarily? Like, would there be a catastrophe that happened that kind of forced them, or is this just something that happens over time, kind of by chance?
So it just happens over time. In the case of the yucca moths, if we just think about the southeast species, one of the things that was interesting, so in the time that I was working on this project, so we were working in Florida. So one of the interesting things about Florida is biogeographically, it's not always been a part of the U.S. It was cut off by a sea when sea levels were higher. Mm-hmm. And so it was its own little island. Mm. And the Lake Wales Ridge, which is the highest point, which is not saying a whole lot, is 200 feet above the sea level. So this goes down the spine of Florida. So near Lake Placid and mm-hmm, so forth. Mm-hmm. And so that spine, there's all these interesting evolutionary relics that have been isolated from the mainland of the U.S. And so one of the things that we discovered while I was there, there was another postdoc and graduate student that were actually looking at the genetics of the moths. And there's a moth species in Florida that is a sister taxa, mm-hmm. closely related, but a distinct species. Mm-hmm. So morphologically, it looks identical to the one that's on the mainland U.S., but its behavior is different. So if you're watching them in the field, you can tell it's a different species. But morphologically, if you just have them in a museum, you mm-hmm. wouldn't be able to tell. And so anyway, so that one got named as a new species, Tegeticula cassandra, after being a little puzzle. So anyway, I say that, and so that wasn't discovered until, you know, the late 1990s, early 2000s. So discovering new species when you look closely mm-hmm. at things that look similar. And whereas in the mainland U.S., it's Tegeticula yuccacella is the main pollinator moth. And then there's also cheaters that have evolved in this system. Mm. So anyway, I guess my point is when you dive into these specialist systems, it almost always ends up being more complicated. And there's multiple players. And so, yeah, it's a really fascinating puzzle to kind of tease it apart. But mm-hmm. that field work is so important to seeing what's going on.
So you mentioned that there's the hurricanes about to hit Florida tomorrow as we're recording this. And obviously that could have really significant impacts on the soil, the plants, the insects. Why is that? Why would wiping out something have such dramatic impacts on the broader ecology of that area? And why we think about the people of the hurricane, and obviously that's, you know, a huge thing, but there's also the question of what these kinds of natural disasters can do to the environment down there. And we don't always think about the broader effects that can have. Can you speak to that a little bit?
Yeah, so in the case of the yuccas and the yucca moths, I think the good news is that if there's, so the plants have rhizomes that go under the soil. If there's any fragment of that rhizome, it will come back up again. Mm-hmm. And for the moths, at this point in time, they are buried under the soil. They're not. So if this had happened back in April or May, this would be bad. But right mm-hmm. now, they're under the soil. So, and there's a whole bunch of yuccas and yucca moths like on Tybee Island in Georgia. Hurricanes periodically happen. So I'm less worried about them mm-hmm. surviving and being able to come back because mm-hmm. they're used to that kind of disturbance. But there are some other organisms. So, for example, the scrub jays are a unique species of blue jay down in Florida that don't really occur, the Florida scrub jays. So some of those organisms, I think, are at higher risk. The biggest risk in Florida is actually loss of habitat. So some of the sites that I worked on as a postdoc are now orange groves. So they just no longer exist. And actually, that's true in Tennessee, too. Some of the cedar glades that I worked in that were extraordinary are now a race car track.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So actually, loss of habitat tends to be a bigger issue.
Okay.
But disturbances.
In my husband always gets mad at me because there's this thing I learned about a few years ago called No Mow May, where for the listeners who don't know, you don't mow your yard, your lawn, or businesses don't mow their places for the month of May so they can help promote insects and the habitats of things that need that space to live. So I, every year, insist that we do not mow our lawn, which is a pretty big lawn. My husband hates it. Is that actually something that is helpful to our local, you know, environment and the things that live here in South Bend and the other places that do this? Is that a beneficial thing we can do as humans to help? Yeah.
So that's a really good question. No Mow May was started in kind of northern Wisconsin. So May in northern Wisconsin is different than May in Indiana. And then the other thing is, I would say, what's the habitat? Like, when you don't mow, are you just allowing weeds to come up? So, for example, promoting dandelions and grasses and white clover is actually not so helpful to our native bees.
Mm-hmm.
So I think No Mow May has been good in terms of raising awareness mm-hmm. of our landscaping practices. I think there are better ways that we can actually support the ecology and biodiversity. So the number one thing, planting native mm-hmm. plant species. That alone will be the most beneficial. And so the No Mow May has, I think, raised some awareness about that. But the actual practice, probably not so helpful. Not as helpful as planting native plants.
Sure. All right, my husband will be happy to hear that.
Yeah, but I think you're right, though. It does. It makes people wonder because it makes people ask the question, why are we actually doing this? And then people start thinking about pollinators.
Right.
And, you know, obviously a big part of not just the ecosystem, but also a big part of the economy as well, because mm-hmm. we need pollinators to pollinate the food, you know, the plants, the food that we eat. So
yeah.
That in itself, I think when I first heard about No Mow May, I said, well, I usually don't mow my grass for a long time anyway. And my neighbor kind of gives me the look every now and then. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, it started, you know, we started asking questions. Okay, what is this really about? And, you know, it helped us understand a little bit more about what pollinators can do.
So one thing that I would promote is leave the leaves.
Mm.
So this is a fall thing. And so as much as possible, obviously you have to rake the leaves away from sidewalks and from the road and driveways and so forth. But to the extent that you can leave leaves whole, do not mow them up, allows many insects to complete their life cycle. And so when you pack up all those leaves, you're eliminating all that nutrient input mm-hmm. into the soil. When you mow over them, you're chopping up all the insects that are in there, fireflies, many insects that are cocooning. So I mentioned the yucca moths, mm-hmm. for example. They're just under the surface. So leave the leaves to the extent that you can is actually a really helpful process. So you don't have to rake this weekend. Get out and enjoy the lovely
weather.
All right,
I'm going to tell my husband that too.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Scientist says don't rake.
Yeah.
I think my kids will be very happy about that.
Yeah.
Because that's who actually does most of the raking.
Can I ask one more question about this? And then I know, Shahir, you have a couple other questions.
Of course.
Is there a good resource you could point people to find native plants that they can add to their landscape? How do people go about doing that?
Yeah, we have some really good resources in Indiana. So there's the Indiana Native Plant Society. So you can go to their website. You can just type in Google Indiana Native Plant Society. They have a resource page where you can look at what are all the nurseries in Indiana that sell native plants. Locally, we have a North chapter that's active in doing hikes and providing information. And then there's also Wild Ones, which is a national organization, but we also have a local chapter that's very active, and they are developing resources. They just had a plant sale, actually, this last weekend. And I think every fall and spring they have a plant sale, and that's local in South Bend. So, so Wild Ones in that. And then you can also look at Homegrown National Park. So this is the idea of trying to decrease your lawn space by half. And that one has many good resources, and you can drill down. This is my zip code. What are the resources in my area? So Homegrown National Park is great.
You wrote that down, Julia. I'm going to ask you.
I wrote that down. Okay. Yes, Homegrown National Park.
Perfect. I'm always trying to find native plants to add to our, you know, yard, and I don't always know what I'm doing. So that's really helpful to have some resources. So thank you. Here, I know you have a few. I've been hogging your questions. Sorry.
No. This is perfect. I really love this conversation because we already covered a lot of the things that I've been curious about, because I know very little about ecology. Mm-hmm. It was actually, you mentioned Professor Riemann Schneider.
Oh,
and
yes.
He was actually my professor of ecology when I took the ecology class a long time ago. But I did not have the maturity level maybe to appreciate ecology. I thought that molecular biology and, you know, just kind of like looking at molecular things, that was my interest at the time. And I'm starting to appreciate ecology a lot more. I started appreciating that right after I left college, was just by just observing how trees change over the seasons, you know. And it's something that I'm starting to have a lot more appreciation for, and just being out in my yard and, you know, with my kids and, you know, planting different things. It is beautiful. So I just want to know, what got you interested in ecology in the first place? Is this something you always wanted to do, or what was your path to it?
I was really fortunate. As a high school student, I was able to attend a summer session on aquatic invertebrates. So I was learning how to identify invertebrates. So this is in upstate New York. We have tons of bogs. So I spent that summer mucking through bogs and streams and creeks. We collected things, and then we identified them under the microscope. And I was like, if I could do this for a living, I would love it. And then in college, I started biology. Honestly, when I got to organic chemistry my second year, I almost quit. But I had the most lovely TA in organic chemistry. He was from Korea. And he said, you obviously have a passion for biology. Stick with it. So I did. And it wasn't until my junior year that I got to take ecology, evolution. And then I was like, okay, this is what I really, my mind just... Mm-hmm. I don't know, something clicks. What I loved about it, especially the ecology courses, you could look at things and sort of make sense of the world. What was going on? You could learn what's the inner story of, you know, what's happening in the soils, what's when I walk through the forest, what's really going on.
Yeah.
And so it was those courses that kept me in biology. And then I've been able to do so, but doing field work has been a big part of that. So I think doing the direct observation is what gets me excited.
Yeah.
And I'm constantly learning new things.
That's the fun part about it. Mm-hmm. Right. And it's that one point where you say, hey, if I could just get paid to do this every day.
Mm-hmm.
And well, you know, and we just, you know, as scientists, that's what we do. We make all the big bucks doing that, of course, right?
Yes. Yeah, not really, but
all
okay.
All of it, right? All the money doing that. But that's like when something turns on, and especially when you get to those upper level courses. And I think that's always an issue, or often an issue, where sometimes you just can't get through those first few courses. But once you get to the upper level courses, you're like, this is exactly what I wanted to do.
Which is partly why in the intro courses, I'm very mindful. Am I pulling in a diverse set of things and tools so that somebody can find at least one thing that maybe makes them excited and see, okay, this is worth spending some time on and really learning.
Yes. Yeah. And the students that you teach, are they mostly biology students that are studying to be biologists, or is it a more diverse crowd than that?
So it's mostly biologists, but it can be more diverse. So, for example, computer science students need to take a science course outside of computer science. So we get quite a few computer science. We also have quite a few health science people that are interested in rehabilitation science, exercise science, that kind of thing. And then also biology, the intro biology sequence is required for people interested in health professional fields like medicine, pharmacy, optometry. And so the students that are in the course have fairly diverse career interests. And the trick is to convince them that everything is worth. Because the thing, I've had the advantage of being at this a long time, and I see the connections. I see the connections between calculus and ecology.
Yeah.
I see the connections between chemistry, why that's so fundamental. Why does every biologist take 20 credits of chemistry?
Yeah.
Why do we need physics? Physics is integral to what we do. But it's taken me a long, obviously, when I took organic as an undergrad, I didn't have that. When I took calculus as an undergrad, I didn't have that context. And I wish, I think it's something you have to just keep at it to start seeing those connections. You can't do it all at once, right?
No, you have
to build those connections over time.
But, yeah, you can't do it all at once. And you have to kind of take it a little bit at a time. And then it's almost like later on that the curtain is revealed. And then you see how all of these courses connect to each other, and they each give you some sort of tool that you're going to need later on.
And way of thinking. You really need to be a flexible thinker.
Yes. Yeah.
And when you're looking at problems, never assume you know. Things will surprise you all the time. And so you really have to be very good. What am I seeing? How can I test what I think I'm seeing? So being really critical about how you design experiments, how you're looking at the data. Are you biased? Is there another way? So this is why undergraduates are great. They don't have as many biases as I do.
Yeah, right.
So they're like, oh, I think this. And I'm like, oh, I would never think that because that's just, I haven't,
Yeah, you have your own experience, and I'm sure that affects how you see things as a scientist. But so that's very important then in terms of mentorship, that it's not something that you are necessarily just endowing students with. Mm-hmm. Obviously, you're helping them with a lot of things, but in a way, they're also helping you because they're challenging you to see things in a different point of view.
Yeah,
right? Correct.
Yeah, and they'll be asking questions. I'm like, oh, I haven't thought of it that way.
Haven't thought about it.
But it gets me thinking. Okay, have we missed something? Do we need to redesign the experiment to include that idea?
Right, and I think that from an outsider point of view, there's this maybe conceived idea that professor just tells you what to do. Here it is, because we know it, and we've always known it. And you're just going to do it or you're going to get a big fat F. But you're saying that's not necessarily the case.
That's not the case. Yeah. I mean, I've taught for years. Animals are the only ones that have centrosomes. But it's turning out that it's way more complicated than that. So back to that cell division thing. But we don't know everything.
And I also did not realize that ferns have so many chromosomes.
The majority, over 95% of ferns are polyploid.
Yeah.
And they have a different mechanism for how the cells divide. So I've always wondered, is that because they organize their mitotic spindle differently, is that why they can have so many chromosomes per cell?
Yeah.
Whereas an animal cell, there are some animals that can have higher numbers, but nothing in the thousands. Yeah.
Plants are much cooler at these things than
plants
we are.
Plants are way cooler.
Way cooler.
Much cooler in terms of how they reproduce.
Yes. They're far more. It seems like they're having a lot more fun with it than we are.
Right, that's hard to. That's hard to test.
That's hard to test, but you know, it's just a feeling. Yeah. Community and some of the work that you're doing with science communication, and you are involved with the series that's where you're featuring scientists, but also some artists as well. Mm-hmm. Maybe this is called Our Universe Revealed, and this is happening here in South Bend.
Yes,
tell us a little bit more about it, your involvement in it, and what you see it actually doing within the community.
Yeah, so 3 years ago, we started a partnership between University of Notre Dame, IU South Bend, and then the St. Joseph County Public Library. And actually, before that, I think for 6 years, there was a postdoc in physics who had been running this series, but it was just physics and astronomy. So the idea was bring it to the community, put it in a public library so it's more accessible to everybody, And then and open it up to other fields of science. So the first year we opened it up to all fields of science. And I started moderating that series that first year. So this was 3 years ago. And then last year we added in music and art. Because the library has a theme of STEAM for everyone. Yes. So both the science fields and then the arts for everyone. So this kind of fits within the library's goal.
So the STEAM is just science, technology, engineering, art, and math.
Yes. Right. Okay. All the STEM, all the science fields, STEM field, as well as art and music.
Wonderful.
So for me, I love this. So the goal of the presenters, we have a different person each month. And a really wide range of topics, literally from studying galaxies to studying what's happening in microbiology inside cells. So like the whole size range, and shall we say. We also had one on dark matter, so that's even smaller. But it's great because it gets you thinking about our universe. So one of our goals is to provide an accessible talk to anybody. It's free. And it allows you to, when you learn something new that's completely outside of your field, it gets you curious about yourself, it gets you curious about the world, it gets you curious about the universe. So it's been a really fun series. And what I love about this is the audience has been fabulous. They ask really good questions. Every single lecture has been great with great questions, really thought-provoking questions. So there was one last week that was on art and chemistry. And so Bahram Moasser was presenting on that and talking about how in a chemistry course he's included art and how studying art can help you see things that help you understand chemical molecules. And it was just fascinating. I mean, we were studying paintings and sculptures, but then also thinking about chemistry. So some of those organic chemistry.
Yeah, maybe that's what
chirality. That's
what
honestly would have helped me as a student. It would have helped me to have that anchor. So there are these links between the arts and music and science that I think help you understand things better. So anyway, it was a fascinating talk last week. It's on. If you go to the Our Universe Revealed website, you can look up any of the talks that have been given, but that one should be there within the next couple weeks.
Oh, very good. Yes. Shahir and I were both at that, and it was an incredible talk. Yeah, very good.
It was fantastic. Yeah. And every time I've gone to any one of these series, they've been really fantastic and very much approachable to the community, which I think is really nice. So, and what's really nice about this is that our community here in South Bend can come and see it in person, but then everything is online. So you can you have a YouTube channel that basically after a couple of weeks, a couple of weeks after the recording, it's produced and then put out there.
So you can see past talks. You can explore that. And I would challenge everyone to choose a topic you know nothing about. I've been, so many of these, I've gone in knowing really very, very little. I really don't study galaxies. I haven't looked through a telescope a lot, but it's so fascinating, what's happening in other galaxies and how do we study that?
Yeah.
So it's as much about what methods do you use and how do we understand that kind of problem? So anyway, I find it really interesting. I've loved being a part of the series.
It's been fantastic and it's really been nice to see how creative scientists have been to actually study some of these things that are literally outside of our galaxy, because you have to get really, really creative in terms of like the ways that you actually even ask the questions. It's that's been, I think, the big take home for me from these, and just the connection that they have to art as well.
And if you think about how new knowledge is produced, it's making new connections. So the way you're going to do that is by challenging yourself to get out there and explore, try, look at different fields, because it gets you thinking differently. And so then you start approaching the question differently.
Right.
Yeah. What would be something really interesting or surprising that people who maybe have never taken an ecology class that you think they'd find interesting from the research you've done or something you've learned in a class that you've been teaching that's like stands out as the most interesting thing? I'm sure there's so many to choose from, but like you could just tell people one really cool thing.
Ecology really matters. It really does. And the more that I've been diving into this, so I've been doing ecology for over 30 years now. And I think one of the cool things this year, so diving into this soil project mm-hmm. with the city of South Bend. And so we've started, so soils are kind of a black box. And certainly I started thinking pretty much above ground early in my career. And now the last 10 years, I've really been thinking below ground, what's happening in the soil, as well as above ground, because what's happening below ground mm-hmm. affects mm-hmm. what happens above ground.
Right.
Meaning that what happens in the soils affects where the plants live or die. It affects species interactions. So one of the cool things is that, so we're studying soils and looking at these invertebrates. And one of the pictures, or so there have been a global study was published last year. It was a review of looking at soil biodiversity on all the continents in urban areas and in rural areas. Mm-hmm. And when you look at urban areas, they tend to have lower diversity of critters living in the soil. And this affects us in profound ways. Not only it's going to affect nutrient cycling, it's going to affect how plants grow, but it also affects us. So the more, the fewer microbes that you have in the soil, the lower diversity, they tend to get overrun by pathogenic bacteria and fungi. They also, you tend to get more methanotrophic bacteria. So then you get more methane, a greenhouse gas being emitted mm-hmm. into the atmosphere. But also when you have less diversity in terms of microbes in the soil, it affects our skin microbiota.
Wow.
And so our skin, if you, so they did this lovely study in Finland, for example, they looked at 10 daycare centers, and in some of them, the kids were just playing every day for 1.5 hours on a man-made playground. Some were playing in a playground that had a lot of natural areas. And then they did one where they did a transition where it started off man-made and then they added in peat blocks. They literally added in forest floor leaf litter.
Uh-huh.
And they had these peat blocks that the kids could play on. They had soil that the kids could plant plants in. And over 1 month, the microbiota diversity on their skin increased and their immune system function improved.
Wow.
They produced fewer cytokines. So by having more diverse bacteria on the skin, they had fewer cytokines that promote inflammation and better all like T cell regulation. So for example, fewer allergies. So if your T cells are out of whack, your ability to tell what's yourself versus an allergy, something coming in gets out of whack. And so if you have better diversity of microbes on your skin, it improves immune function, inflammation response. So that's all happening at the cellular level,
right?
But it's ecology. Like you have to understand. So ecology is about understanding the connections between things, whether you're thinking at the cellular level or if you're thinking at a global level. So with the methane production, so then we're thinking about greenhouse gases. That's kind of a global issue.
Right.
But you can also think, how is it affecting us, our ability to breathe, asthma, allergies, and so forth. So anyway, I find ecology completely fascinating because it's the connections between the different levels of organization, and it matters.
Yeah. So it's okay that my kids are dirty because they've been playing outside.
You're doing great. Okay. You're doing great.
All right. Good. I'm not a bad mom because my kids are rolling around in the dirt.
No.
I'm making them healthier.
Yes.
Making them healthier.
Okay.
Better
Very
immune
good.
System. And so that's something that's come up before in our podcast about, you know, kind of gut health. We talked about the gut microbiome, which is an ecosystem in of itself. But it didn't occur to me that the soil bacteria and their diversity is also important for our immune system.
So it's important for our skin microflora.
Right.
And I guess as a kid, you might be ingesting some as well.
I'm sure.
So that diversity is important at many different levels, including just within the human body.
Mm-hmm. Right. That's fascinating. That's amazing. Well, I have one more question for you. So you are also an artist.
Not really.
you are a musician.
I can't draw. I can draw circles and lines.
But you play music.
I play music, yes.
Play music.
Yes.
You play the piano.
Yes.
Tell us a little bit about that, because I don't actually know very much about that part. All I know is that you play the piano.
Yeah.
But tell us how you started and what you do with it. But also, how does that actually How does that play into your life as a scientist?
Yeah, so I've played piano for a long time. So I started taking lessons in first grade. Mm-hmm. And then in, I think it was, so ninth grade, I started taking piano lessons in Binghamton. So that's an hour away. So every other week we were traveling an hour for piano lessons. I also accompanied theater. So mm-hmm. I accompanied every single theater production we had in high school. I also accompanied ballet classes, you know, behind. I played in the jazz band, so I was even in the marching band. I was too little to carry the marimba, so I had to stand up front at the desk and play the marimba. So anyway, I've done a lot of keyboard things all throughout. And then when I got to college, I continued piano. Mm. And this was probably one of the most important things I could have done. Mm. So I had a fabulous piano teacher. He was Walter Ponce. He's from Bolivia. He got his degree from Juilliard. He's a world-class pianist. And he really challenged me. And when you study piano, you have to learn the piece until you can, you do it until you get it.
Yes.
And whereas in I was at the same time, I was in science classes where I was with 300, 400 of my closest friends taking exams. And there you're on a schedule. Like whenever the exam comes up, that's when you do it. And both things were important. But the nice thing about piano is that you really develop that individual ability to tackle a project and see it through to the end. And it was one of the most important things I could have done for graduate school. Mm. So obviously the science knowledge is important, but right. the music background and learning how to take projects from beginning to end. And then it's also just been good, you know, so I don't really play publicly anymore, but through college I made my money playing for the theater classes, accompanying, right. that's how I made money. It was good.
That's so cool.
Yeah, I remember the few times I would see you at IUSB coming down the chemistry hallway to meet with Dr. Gretchen Anderson. You guys would sneak away and play piano together.
So for 17 years, Gretchen and I played piano duets, and it was fabulous because when we started, we had a little piano. So when so 3 years after I moved here, I had enough money to buy a house. So I bought a house. As soon as I bought the house, the first thing I did is now I can get a piano.
Mm. Absolutely.
So that summer, we went on the piano hunt, and Gretchen went with me on this piano hunt.
Yeah.
And we looked at all the areas here in South Bend, but we ended up going to Chicago a couple of times to go piano. And that's where I ended up getting the piano. And so getting that piano. But then that prompted Gretchen, who was starting to get back into taking lessons. Mm-hmm. And so we started playing duets. And so we would just get together periodically. At first it was like maybe kind of sporadic, but those last couple of years we were getting together every week. Mm-hmm. And we tackled so much piano literature. And we improved. I mean, because we just kept at it.
Yeah.
And it was lovely to share that.
Yeah.
Yeah, that partnership is really important in music, of course. It's really fantastic. And just going, it's just getting better because you're doing more of it.
Yeah. And we could, you know, the last couple of years, Gretchen wanted to work on her emoting. Mm-hmm. So we would purposely choose pieces that like would make you really angry. Mm-hmm. You could just bang away. And then others that were very soft and delicate. And those that were fun. And so you can release emotion without having to talk about things.
Yeah. Yeah.
So for an introvert, it's great.
Yeah, I'm sure. All right. Well, we don't want to keep you any longer. I know you're busy teaching and doing cool research. So thank you so much for joining us on our podcast.
This has been just lovely.
Yeah. I learned so many cool things. I'm going to go read, watch some cool videos and learn more about plants and insects and fungi and all that. So.
I'm going to go plant some native plants in my backyard.
Oh, yeah. That too. I'm going to look up some native plants.
Exactly.
Not rake my leaves this weekend.
Yay.
Yeah, that's one less thing.
One less thing to do.
That's right.
Yeah.
Just freed up your schedule.
I'll say it. Scientist told me not to do it.
That's right.
Very good.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
Of course.
Thank you.
Thanks, Dan.
At the end of our show, we would like to thank you, our lovely listeners, and our awesome audience for spending your time with us. We thank the Notre Dame College of Science and the Indiana University South Bend College of Arts and Sciences. Special thanks to the wonderful people at the Notre Dame Studios.
coming to you from beautiful South Bend, Indiana, in the heart of the Rust Belt. This is Rust Belt Science. I'm Shahir Risk.
And I'm Maggie Fink.
And we'll catch you next time.